Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, Greasers. Hope you're having an okay week. I recommended candles the other week. I just want to recommend Tony's Chocolate. I think it's the only way I've survived so far lockdown. I will just flag that if you buy one, it will be gone by the end of the day. That's the only thing I will say. This isn't sponsored in any way, shape or form. This is a public service announcement. This week, I'm talking to the extraordinary Jess Mills. Jess is a musician, a podcaster, and a founder of the Tessa Jow Foundation. Tessa Jow was, in fact, her mum, which is why Tess now heads up the Tessa Jow Foundation, where she's leading the delivery of her mother's legacy. And Jess came in to talk to me about her mum, who died of a rare brain cancer just 10 weeks after Jess had given birth.
It's been okay. I mean, it's been a mixture of like highly intense and highly okay at times. You know, I've got two small children and have had lots of different kind of worky things that I've been having to juggle. I mean, there's a few different things that I do, kind of between music and the podcast, and then also setting up my mum's legacy foundation. So it's been, I mean, come on, it's been fucking mental, basically. But we're all still standing, aren't we? And I just think,
I know.
For me, this whole thing about COVID being the ultimate leveler, I just thought, it just felt so grossly wrong. You know, I think, if anything, it's just amplified kind of inequality even more profoundly, both in people's experiences of it and also how visible it is. And I, you know, and within that, I think as somebody who has incredible, you know, security and privilege in their life, I just feel like I just shouldn't fucking complain about anything.
I think you'll use the right term of like, we all have an experience in common, but the experience is very different.
Yeah.
But so you mentioned her already, but I do always ask the questions. Who are we remembering today?
We are remembering my mum, Tessa Jow.
Tessa Jow,
yes.
Which I think for most people would ring a bell because obviously she was a politician up until recently.
Yeah, till recently. So my mum was what she was most well known for was, I suppose, like the last sort of 15, 20 years of her career, when she was a minister and Secretary of State in Tony Blair's government, and she was public health minister. But she... Mum was known and loved for being so much more than that. She was a truly authentic person through and through, and you know, the way that she would kind of show up and show love and enthusiasm, and her just kind of unconditional sense of kind of support for people would be the same as that she would show for a friend as she would for her constituents, and or for her colleagues in Westminster. And so I think what she's most known for now, I think one of her greatest legacies beyond the very, very brilliant and impactful work she did as a politician in her life, is just actually what a totally wonderful human being she was. And she really was. And I am just infinitely, infinitely proud of everything that she is and that she was.
It's really, I always find it really interesting talking to people who have lost someone who was such a public figure, because I think it is a slightly, not different, just the circumstances are different, you know what I mean? That, like, so, you know, when she died, it was something that was news. And I mean, I wonder, we can maybe get on to talk about that. So how long ago was it? What was the...
So, Mum died, and I have to still get my head around the D word, but I have to say it because she died. She did die. I still find it so... It feels so brutal and awful in my mouth every single time I say it, but I'm making myself not say passed away because I just have to start accepting more what has happened. And I think being able to use that language, I think for me is an important part of it. So she died 2 years ago in May, on the 12th of May 2018.
So it's still very, very you know, raw and fresh is the wrong word, but it's the only word I think of, like, talking to someone who's 20 years plus down the line. I think 2 years is still very, very early, and I completely understand. I think I've said this on the show before, but I was having therapy, and I used to always say, my dad died when I was 15. Boom, there's a sentence. I haven't really acknowledged it. Like, it's not, do you know what I mean? It wasn't connecting. And then she once was like, oh, you say it like he's still doing something. And I was like, what? She was like, you don't say, like, my dad is dead. And I was like, because he's not. Like, I had completely done the same thing. That word, I'd made it this phrase that was safe. Like you said, like, for me, it was passed away. It's like, my dad died when I was 15. It didn't mean much. But having to say, oh, my dad's dead, I found that, like, yeah, unbelievably difficult all of a sudden.
I can't bear it, actually. And even having just saying it then, you know, my heart is now kind of racing quite galloping in my throat. And it's a very, very triggering word for me, saying that she's dead. And it just feels too awful a thing to say about her.
It's so, when language becomes so real,
exactly,
you know, like, and it's very easy to be in grief and not, and it's really hard to explain, I think, if it hasn't happened to you, because it sounds like you're saying, like, you don't believe it, or you in your head you think they're still alive, and it's not that. It's just, you're just not saying the words, like, looking at it directly, I guess. It's like the sun, isn't it? You're just like, it's there with you, but you're not completely facing it, because it's deeply painful. And I'm not surprised. Jess, 2 years in is really early in a grief journey and grief experience.
Yeah, and it does still feel like that, and it does still, I mean, it's still on very much in the tip of my consciousness, you know, and on the kind of surface of all of my senses. And I, just to kind of go back to what you were just saying, it's just so true. And, you know, the language around passing away and died, it's got a kind of active component. Somehow within it, there's an implication of living still.
Yeah, definitely. That's what my therapist said. She said, you say it like he's running.
Yeah.
Like he died.
Yeah.
He's running. He's out for a walk. He's just at work. Like, it seemed active.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's the absolutely kind of hard end stop of the word dead, which is just so, it's very, very painful to say. And I also think there comes a time when you have to lean into it as part of your process of kind of acceptance. For me anyway, accepting completely without fire or rage or fury or devastation about what's happened is actually proving to be quite a big part of what's enabling me to kind of to start what feels like healing. Death is just so weird. It's so weird, because even though this person dies, or is dead, there is still so much continuity of them that continues.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of pulled between, it's the physical absence, but then still the kind of resonance of so much of them still. It's a very, very, very odd hinterland. It really, yeah, really is. And I think I'm kind of still in that. You know, it's been 2 years, which is in some ways an impossibly long time to have not seen her or spoken to her. You know, someone that I spoke to every single day, or, you know, saw, you know, 2 or 3 times a week, even as an adult. But in other ways, it is a very short amount of time too, you're right. And I and particularly because, you know, mum wasn't, you know, mum got ill very, very, well, we learnt of her being ill basically overnight, you know, there wasn't, and then from the point at which she was diagnosed to when she died was less than a year. So it's actually been 3 years. I mean, three years ago the bomb had just detonated, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And just to remind people, what was it she died of?
So mum was at the end, on the 24th of May, 3 years ago, she was on her way to go and host an event in East London, to which was all about promoting the re-stimulation of Sure Start, which was her life's passion, early childhood, and it was one of the things that she did in the Labour government that was actually one of the Labour government's greatest successes, but also one of the things that she was most well known for. And she was on her way to host the event, and we'd just been on the phone actually just before, and she got in a taxi and suddenly couldn't formulate her words at all. And she remembers all of this part, and then she can't remember what happens after this, but basically what happened was she then lost the ability to speak completely, and luckily the taxi driver that she was with could see something was very severely wrong and took her into the first police station near where they were, which was in Bishopsgate in Liverpool Street, and took her in, and she tried to try to speak and explain to the police what was happening, couldn't formulate her language, and then had a massive seizure in the police station, and then was very, very deeply unconscious, and then was rushed to the Royal London Hospital. She had another huge seizure on the way, and then I mean, there's many stories within this story alone, but I'll keep to the kind of to the main points. Basically, then she started to regain consciousness about 6 hours later, and they thought initially she'd had a stroke. And then they, the next day, did a series of scans to assess what was going on. And then they discovered a 3 centimetre large high-grade brain tumour in the speech and language centres of her brain, which luckily they were able to do surgery on. But the type of brain tumour she had, which was called a glioblastoma, is basically the most aggressive form of not just brain cancer, but cancer that you can mm-hmm. have. And it's very, very difficult to treat. And what happens is the cancer basically, even though you have a kind of large focal point of tumour, you do have a kind of solid tumour, the tumour basically diffuses cancer cells, so you have, it's like a kind of mist that you can't extract out of the brain, basically. So, and then in time, in not much time, that mist starts to kind of form into kind of solid masses. And She was diagnosed officially at the beginning of June, and she died on the 12th of May, less than a year later.
That must have been such a shock to get a diagnosis like that, because it sounds like until that point she was working and, you know, doing events and very present. To suddenly find out, to hear the words tumour and, you know, aggressive and all of that stuff, I think all griefs are unique, all griefs are individual, but yeah, I think cancer grief is a really strange, having been there myself, it's a really strange process, because that diagnosis is when, like you said, your world starts to, like, you know, slip out of focus and you're trying to grasp at it, and then there's just this weird limbo until they die, and then grieving in capital letters begins. But you, as everyone says, the grief process often starts at that diagnosis, because that's when you're told this person doesn't have much time left in you know, some cases of cancer. So yeah, it must have been such a shock.
Well, it was a catatonic shock. I mean, it really was. You know, we went from, you know, what I call the sort of the magic of the ordinary, which is basically all that you want when something like this detonates on your life. You know, the day that Mum had, you know, the few hours before Mum had these seizures, we were on the phone planning her 70th birthday, which was in September at the end of that summer. You know, she was saying, oh, darling, you know, to be honest, whatever we do, I don't mind. If this is what 70 looks like, then I think it's bloody fabulous. Oh. You know, and she said, I've never felt better. She was so fit, so well. She, you know, could do handstands and yoga. She worked out four times a week. She'd just come off the back of running for London Mayor the year before. You know, she was in some ways in a kind of almost a whole new level of dynamism in her in her life and her professional life. I think that also came from being kind of freed up from all the constraints of being a very, very senior politician. And was, you know, she'd been made a very senior fellow at Harvard, and so was spending lots of time in the States. And then I guess the thing that was for me the kind of most intense agony for me about Mum getting ill and then dying when she did was that it intersected directly with me becoming a mother. So what I basically had in that, so my daughter Ottie was born on the 28th of February. Mum was diagnosed on the 24th of May when Ottie was 11 and a half weeks old. And then the first year of Ottie's life, so the first year of me becoming a mother, was basically overlaid with me losing my mum. I never could have anticipated how intensely I needed my mum through becoming a mum myself, and the experience of being mothered by her as a new mother myself was some of the most treasured, precious time of my, happiest time of my life. And I remember being so present with it at the time. And you know, Mum and I had a deeply, deeply, deeply kind of interwoven, kind of molecular closeness. You know, I'm very, very lucky in that I was born into an incredibly loving, big, loving family. And but you know, Mum really, since I was born, throughout my life, has kind of been the central, most important pillar. My whole life. And you know, of course, my life has been built out beyond that for things which are just, which are my own, which are of course now the centres of my world in a different way. But all of it was kind of built upon, built out from the structure that this kind of structure of love and the relationship that I had with my mum, really.
I think that's so interesting to put it like that, to put it like in the terms of structure. And I think that's sometimes what's hard to explain when you do lose a parent, whatever your relationship with them really is, like they are your internal structure, they are your internal foundations. Like even if you don't get on with them, you know, it's like you learn, you have learned, they are the people who showed you this is how to make, this is how we do things.
And
I think that especially when you are so close and you do get on well with a parent and they die, it's like your inner foundations just have crumbled. And there's, I think that there's an organisation, don't know if you've heard them, called Motherless Mothers. I can't remember the lady's name who set it up, but she set it up specifically with that in mind, that when you have to become a mother, it is such a strange, traumatic, evolutionary process of being a woman. And to not have a mother around, like you said, or to have her in being sick at that time must have been just so difficult. And to find out she had cancer when you had an 11-week-old baby, like, I can't imagine. That must have been so, so difficult, because your focus is on this new baby, but then having to have your focus pulled to, like, oh, and now my mum is sick, like, and dealing with doctors and that language when you, you know, you're also trying to wrap up a new baby and shut the doors on it. That must have been so hard, Jess.
Oh, it was absolutely fucking awful.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There's no other way to put it, really. And I, you know, the kind of transition between, you know, the days and weeks and this kind of 3 months before Mum became ill, me and Ottie were kind of the centre of everything that she was doing and wanted to be doing. And she was coming over every day and very much kind of absolutely kind of wrapping us up and looking after us. And then suddenly, you know, she's in hospital, diagnosed with a high-grade brain tumour, that we very, very shortly after were told was terminal. And everything had to change then. You know, she was so brave, Mum. She was so brave and unself-pitying, but she naturally needed a lot of looking after. And so there was a kind of complete turn, you know. I mean, you know, we were up at hers every day. It was very difficult. You know, Mum would come and have, you know, regular time with Ottie, where she would help me with her as well, and just, you know, take her out and look after her. So, and none of that could happen anymore. And there was a triangulation of mine and Mum's relationship when Ottie was born, which was, it was just like everything that we had always had together suddenly just kind of was ripped open into this kind of roaring, amazing kind of technicolor of, you know, her now being a granny. And like, and in lots of ways, you know, when you have a granny who is as involved as Mum was, they're almost like another parent, you know. They know your baby so intimately, and you know, they don't know them from a kind of sanitized perspective of kind of the occasional visit. You know, they're face down in the kind of, you know, the explosive nappies that, you know, cake them in poo from neck to knees. They're kind of mopping me up when I had some really horrible kind of early postnatal depression just after she was born, you know, with the, like, kind of bringing over sanitary pads and then getting the you know, the cabbage out, holding the cabbage on my boob while she was, you know. It was very, very intimately, both in a kind of practical and an emotional sense, kind of very involved way that she was. And so when, you know, we found out, which was basically in the space of a week from when she became ill to we were told that she was terminal.
Oh, that's no time at all, my goodness.
Yeah, 7 days. The onset of how I felt beyond that was, I mean, really my grieving started that day, you know. I've read a lot about this, but, you know, the whole thing about ambiguous loss and how grief starts in relation to a person who is has a terminal illness or very which they will kind of deteriorate from very, very quickly, or actually illnesses like Alzheimer's or cancer, you know, all these things where someone basically starts to they're physically there, but they are changing, your life is changing, what you know your horizons have been completely transformed. And that's really what I felt after Mum was diagnosed, is that, and I didn't know that what I was feeling was grief, because I didn't know what grief was, but I entered a very, 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 very dark space of grief throughout that summer, which was acute for, I guess, for the next kind of 6 months, until I kind of really started to kind of come to terms really with what was happening, and there was some weird kind of normalisation of where we were. And but it was one of Mum's best friends that said it to me, and she just said to me, "My darling, you're grieving." And but it wasn't just, you know, it was grieving for everything, you know, for everything that we were never going to have, you know, the fact that Mum, this kind of newfound relationship and this newfound aspect to our relationship that had just ignited in the most glorious way, suddenly had a very, very definite endpoint on it. And it was really, really, and seeing her with Ottie actually was, you know, there was this moment. It was about 2 weeks before she got ill on my birthday, and every year me and Mum since I was 12 would do the same thing on my birthday, even in peak political years. You know, Mum was the busiest person I knew, but she was also the most generous with her time, and somehow made time for everybody. But you know, as her daughter and her family, it was like that times a million, you know. So I never felt she wasn't available to me. I mean, even when she was in the cabinet, you know, there'd be times when I would call her not knowing that she was in a very busy meeting, and she'd pick up the phone in a hushed voice and go, "Darling, everything okay?" And I was like, "Yeah, can you speak to us? Sweetheart, I'm just in cabinet. Can I call you back?"
just running the country, but like, do you need to be picked up? Or
yeah,
you
just,
okay?
Just in cabinet, yeah.
Right. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
Every year on my birthday, we do the same thing. We'd go for a really brilliant boozy lunch at one of our favourite spots in Soho, and then go shopping in Liberty's on what Mum would call a mini melt, which is basically a short but punchy shopping spree. And Mum, she really hated kind of gross displays of kind of wealth or grandeur or kind of materialism. But she actually, when she was, you know, she didn't have money when she was younger, and she earned everything that she ever had. And, you know, when she was younger, she actually, you know, made all of her own clothes because she couldn't afford to kind of buy lovely clothes. And so a bit of kind of retail therapy, and never kind of lost its novelty on her. Yeah, exactly. And there was this moment just a couple of weeks before she had the seizure, where we were shopping for my birthday, and it was the first birthday after, you know, years and years and years and years since I was 12 that we had Otty. We'd had to rescue a moment when spirits were plummeting, because I had stupidly plucked a load of clothes off the rails, not accounting for the fact that I was probably about fucking two sizes too big.
Oh,
so I had that
horrible moment of
trying to squeeze your fucking enormous tits and stomach and ask into something that was
and
way
you put
too
them on,
fucking
you're like,
small.
What? This is not... I used to be able to...
Hold on a minute, it must be the wrong size.
My body has... Yeah, I had that not that long ago. Yeah, it's
But
really...
this is a long-winded story, but basically... And anyway, we managed, Mum, because she was a bit of a regular in Liberty's, called her friend Celia in personal shopping, who came down and rescued the day with this, like, loads of beautiful things, including there was this, like, one really beautiful, like, very simple but really lovely black silk dress, which I put on. And I remember opening the curtain to the dressing room and seeing Mum and Otty there, stood together. And even then, before I had any idea of what the fuck was going to happen, you know, a couple of weeks later, I saw Otty lying on her shoulder, and she just looked back at me, just kind of, darling, you look gorgeous, let's get it, blah blah blah. And it just seemed to me like it felt like a snapshot of the future and of all of these happy birthday days the three of us were going to have together. And it was a brutal kind of amputation, really, from that to this. And so,
yeah, from a place of very closeness and happiness, and it's grief is always hard, but when you, it sounds like you guys had such a lovely relationship, so there's a real pain to it being taken when it's in such a good place and everything's nice. And when she when it eventually sort of got towards the end, were you with her? What happened then?
Oh, yeah. So at the time I was just before I had Otty, I was kind of working kind of furiously, busily with, between some music stuff I was doing at the time, and also as I was very, very heavily involved with Help Refugees, Choose Love charity, and you know, I was kind of heaving my, you know, 8 month pregnant sized body around Greece and France and the various different projects that we were doing with the refugee communities there. And then when mum got ill, and having the body and then mum getting ill, my world suddenly went from being kind of very big and what felt kind of dynamic to being just incredibly small, you know, just the two. And I feel I kind of withdrew from life completely, really. I
think it's a very common symptom with an illness, is that your life shrinks into your house and then like wherever they're going for treatment and that kind of, and the people you see suddenly become not all those people, and like you said, that dynamism and life that is living somewhere else, it becomes very quiet and very still. And yeah, it's a really strange quietening of living that has to happen when someone is dying.
That's exactly such a beautiful way of putting it. It is a quietening of living. And I think also because your kind of emotional capacity reduces down so much, because every part of you is going into kind of emotionally and practically looking after this person, you just don't have it in you to manage anything at all other than the people that are just so central to your world.
Yeah.
And it really reduces down to who those people are. And so the year that we had was, you know, mum went through treatment, options were very, very limited, and we were told we're almost certainly going to be ineffective. And then we had a year, I mean, months of then trying to access more kind of experimental treatments, which were, none of them had any kind of proven to be curative, but they were things which promised hope. And I think when you're living with somebody who is so central to your universe, who's been given a terminal diagnosis, actually living with hope is the best medicine for everyone of all.
Yeah.
And being told that there's no hope is actually more crushing than a diagnosis itself, you know. And so we were just, but it then became very clear really over Christmas that this thing was starting to really, really starting to rage in a different way. And her last ever kind of public appearance was a speech that she gave in the House of Lords, where she made a call to completely transform cancer care and treatment in the UK. I mean, it's not an overstatement to say that it was a triumphant moment. It absolutely was. I mean, even more so if you knew how poorly she was at that time.
Because I remember that speech. I remember that irony of people listening because of what she'd been going through. But in my head, that was, you know, that wasn't so close to her death. I didn't really, now you say those timelines, I'm like, my goodness, she must have been so, that must have been incredibly, need a lot of strength to stand up and talk about that in the House of Lords when you're suffering yourself.
It was on the 25th of January that she did the speech, and she died on the 12th of May. So it was,
it was
just, you know, just over 3 months. And but, you know, she was a campaigner and a kind of an activist, really, through and through, mum. And so for her doing this speech and instigating this campaign, the legacy of which has been huge and something that I'm working on in a very full-time way to deliver, at that time it was just everything for her. It was so important for her. And a couple of days before she was due to do the speech, and then she also had a series of kind of big press moments as well that week. She did a big interview with Nick Robinson for the Today programme. You know, we were sat at home on the Sunday before this huge, huge week that she had. And her speech by this point was really deteriorating. And she was so fucking hardcore, mum, in the most brilliant way, and very unself-pitying. But she'd become very good at actually masking how difficult it was. And she wouldn't let on to us quite how difficult it was. And if she was struggling for work, I mean, I obviously, because I knew her so well, I could notice a kind of nuance in things that was changing before something, a big step down happened. But she was very good at masking it. But then on the Sunday before this big week that she was going, that she had, we were sat around just having dinner together as a family at her, our house, family house which was then in Highgate, and suddenly, just mid-sentence, she just couldn't. It was literally like her speech, every kind of component of her speech was just kind of scattered like a handful of marbles, and there was absolutely, it was like the motor function to form the words went, the vocabulary went, and it literally just went like that. And it was one of the most kind of distressing moments, really, because it just suddenly felt this thing was so in the room with us. Mm. You know, this thing which we, no matter how much we were trying to apply, you know, all of the kind of lessons of presence and just taking one day at a time, and it was just absolutely in the air we were breathing all together.
I think that's a really powerful way of visualizing it, and that's really interesting, especially with cancer, isn't it? Because you like you said, you do so well, and because you are a family unit and you know how to be, you know, you can very easily slip into family unit and the dynamics and chatting about things that need doing, or what someone so-and-so rang and said this, you know, all that kind of minutiae of a family. And then suddenly to be reminded, like, oh god, yeah, the cancer is still very much here, is, yeah, difficult sounds like a stupid word. Like, it just is difficult, isn't it? I guess it's that thing that we were talking about when you use the phrase dead and dying. It's like, you know, as humans, sometimes things are just too painful, so you constantly sidestep them and look at them from an angle, and then every now and again it slaps you in the face and you're like, oh yeah, this is happening.
Yeah, and it's unavoidable, and it's this weird thing of basically what you're talking about is a kind of cluster of cells of, like, yeah, this tiny biology small enough to hold in your hand, yet has the power to fucking destroy your whole, you know, destroy your whole family. I mean, it's just so weird. And this day, this moment, it was the most kind of tangible sense of that. And then obviously with the build up to this massive week that she was about to have, but Mum, she just turned to us and she just smiled and she sort of gestured as if to say it's okay to us. And, you know, we were all really trying to hold it together, but were clearly all very distressed by what was going on. Anyway, she wrote down on a piece of paper that she wanted to go and see her oncologist the next day to get some steroids. So she went down to the Marsden, picked up a load of steroids, which probably should have lasted her for a few weeks, basically dosed herself up.
Oh my god.
Didn't even really tell it. I don't know how many of them she took, but she dosed herself up so heavily that the next morning she was like sharp as a fucking button.
Oh my god.
She was just like, fuck this thing if it thinks it's going to stop me from doing this week. So every single moment of that, you know, every single syllable of that speech when she took to her feet that day was a moment of sheer and utter grit, determination to get through it, which is why, you know, not only was it a triumph for what it was kind of communicating, but it was just a very, very unbelievable human triumph of determination and absolute kind of fire to live, to absolutely fucking live, even when under the shadow of your own death, you know. And I obviously, I didn't know then how little time we had left. We only had if you know, 3 months left, but now what I can see is that she was living even more fiercely under the shadow of her death as a result of it. But, you know, just to talk about the end, as you said, I never spoke about Mum dying with her. We never spoke about it explicitly. It was just too painful to say it out loud. Yeah. I mean it was latent, obviously, amongst us all, because we all knew what was happening. And obviously between my dad and my brother and me and the rest of our family, it was all we could talk about. But with Mum, it was never a conversation that any of us had with her directly, although I learned afterwards it was a conversation she had with her friends. But it didn't mean we were kind of, it wasn't because there was a denial of it. I just think some things are too painful to talk about. And if there was ever a moment where she could feel that it was just weighing particularly heavy on me, she would just say, I love you forever, darling. I love you forever. I love you forever and ever and ever. And And I feel that now, you know, even though she's gone, I feel her love. I feel she loves me forever. It's the most extraordinary thing, really. Which is why this whole thing of being motherless, I don't feel motherless, weirdly. I don't feel motherless. I feel the love and the mothering I had from her. She loved me in a way that has kind of enabled me to navigate my way without her.
I've said before, like, I think all you can do as a parent is love them so hard and so much that when you die, they still know it.
Exactly.
Like, that's basically, you can't control anything else, but you can love them so hard that, like, when you go, they still feel like, oh my God, they're still squeezing me. Okay. And that's wonderful if you can achieve that, as she obviously did with you. That's so wonderful. And it doesn't, I'm getting better. And, you know, God, I'm still learning my grief journey at holding two things at the same time. Because I think for a long time, you're just like, well, I'm just so sad and that's so overwhelming and that's so painful. And I'm trying to get better at being like, but yet they still love me and yet I still feel their love. And the two things exist at the same time. You can feel that pain and such exquisite sadness that it's like physical.
It's a howling sadness, isn't it?
Yeah. And then at the same time, you can still feel that love. Mm. And that, I think, is, you know, that for me has been such a big part of my, not acceptance, really. I don't know if you ever get to that place, but just learning to sit with what happens to you. Mm. And being like, yeah, I do know that he loved me and I do feel it still, and yet it's still very painful and sad, and it still makes me occasionally want to throw things and be like, well, why did that happen? That's not fair. And I think, yeah, it's hard as humans, we want one or the other, we want truths, you know. And it's like, actually the truth is it's extremely painful and sad. And she really, really loved you. And those, like, they're sort of intertwined together. And it's like you said, like, you almost, I do understand not having those conversations. Obviously, like, some people want to, and if you want to and you can, wonderful. But it sounded like you didn't have any doubt with your relationship. There wasn't any, like, oh, you know, we need to discuss this problem or this thing. It's like, it sounded like you both knew absolutely wholeheartedly that you loved each other. So I can understand, you know, discussing the death just being,
there was just nothing that was left unsaid. There was nothing more that needed to be said between us, you know, ever, you know, other than just wanting to have more living and life together. But it's there was nothing that was unsaid. And I think that definitely is incredibly emancipating, actually. It's freeing. One of the most amplified feelings I have, alongside the kind of what at times still feels like kind of howling, deep howling sadness, is gratitude. And it just amplifies everything that I just feel so grateful for in my life. And even when Mum was dying, and even, you know, after, you know, very, very shortly after she died, those were still very, very acute feelings for me. And to feel so grateful for everything that we had, you know, even though you, of course, you always want more. How could you not want more life and living with one of the people that you love most in your world? But, you know, even with Otty, where for me and my kids, you know, that for me is the rawest place of my grief, that Mum isn't here to be with them, and not having the kind of that next step of the kind of maternal experience of her through the experience of her being a granny with the girls. And I, not just my kids, my brother as well, who had his first daughter Skye after Mum died, so she never met my brother's and him and his wife Ella are about to have their second baby. And that to me is, I mean, with everything else, I can apply a lens where I say, you know what, how lucky were you to have had this absolutely glorious, like, life-defining, loving, incredible relationship with your mum till you were 37. And how lucky are you to that? You know, some people who lose their parents, or a parent when they're very, very little, or so every part of that I'm counting the blessing and the gratitude of. But with the girls, it's where I find myself feeling most raw, and where it feels most cruel.
I totally understand. And I wonder with children, when you do have children and there's a parent not there, say it, carry on, dead. It's something because that experience is so joyful. So like the rest of your life, like there might be hard bits or, you know, it's more complicated. But when you see grandparents or grandchildren, most of the time, obviously it's not everyone's experience, it's normally just a joyful experience. And especially if, you know, you had seen her with Otty and you knew she would be a lovely granny, it becomes, like I said, that really, like you were describing, that raw painful, because you know it just would have been nice, that bit would have been nice. You know, there might have been other things that were difficult, or arguments or work or stress, but her just hanging out with them would only have been nice. It gives it an added spike as it hits you, doesn't it, when you're like, oh, that would have been nice. I think sometimes those are the memories, or not memories, those are the experiences that, like you said, feel raw when you are doing that thing to yourself, when you're like, oh, if they were here. And sometimes I think, oh, if they were here, you know, oh, that it's good he didn't see that, blah blah blah, that I wouldn't have liked that. But it's the ones where you're like, oh no, they would like that. Oh, like, you know, these things are just painful. What was it like, just to go back, we said at the beginning, like when she died and it was sort of newsworthy, was that difficult in any way? Or was that actually, because I've spoken to people who have had parents who are famous for various reasons, but varying from journalism to acting, and all of them have said it's an unusual twist on it that, you know, you're turning on the television and seeing their face, or you're looking at a newspaper and people are discussing them. Did that help? Was it comforting? Or
it was kind of amazing, really. I knew how, I already knew and was incredibly proud of how really universally loved and respected Mum was, and I knew that, and I think she knew that while she was alive too. But the outpouring of love and of tributes and of the kind of mourning of people all over the country, it was just incredible. And in the weird kind of negative space that death is, it was an extension of the celebration of who she was. And that's how I felt about it. I felt it was the kind of expression of what an extraordinary person that she was. And she was.
So you just had your 2-year anniversary, that's right, yeah, in May, and that was in lockdown. How was that, grieving that in lockdown? Like, did that affect it in any way? Or
so I find the last couple of years, so there's a window between Mother's Day and then my birthday and then the 12th of May, which for the last 2 years I have gone into a very, very weird kind of immovably sort of quite dark headspace. So Mother's Day, sort of birthday, and then Mum's anniversary, all in lockdown, it was a really tough few weeks. And but for me, actually, the day that I find the hardest is Mother's Day. Really, I'm surprised by how difficult I find that. I find it the last couple of years, it's actually been one of my worst days, more than Christmas.
Do you think that's due to the, because I have also, it was all right this year actually, but Father, I think because I was distracted with a newborn, so yeah, I was like, I can't really cope with it. But I think that the increase of social media and the increase of people sharing stuff about their wonderfully healthy living parents, like, that for me has sort of, like, again, it just puts it in your face a bit more. I think before, like when I was a teenager and it was Father's Day, I sort of knew about it because you'd walk past Clinton cards and were Father's Day cards. But other than that, your friends didn't say to you, oh my God, it's Father's Day, like, what are we going to do? Like, particularly, it wasn't like an issue. And now, you know, you go onto your Instagram or your Facebook or wherever, where is a place where most of us go to, like, not think and just be like, oh, nice, okay, fine. And you see all these, it becomes so much, it seems to me it's got so much louder, which is lovely and wonderful. I get that people want to shout about their amazing parents, but if you are in the club, it's like suddenly you're like, oh that's what I'm missing. Like, it's so visual, you're like, oh, I see, oh, he came round, did he, and had a barbecue and like held your kids, right? Yeah, that didn't occur to me, that is a thing that I am now missing.
That's exactly right. And I guess for me, because it's still so new, I'm already feeling like that a lot. And so that day is just everything about it. It's just, I think it's the kind of mirror reflection of everyone else, you know, in the sort of, as I said, the kind of the magic of their ordinary lives with their mums. And also it just amplifies something which I don't have, which was one of the most centrally precious things I had in my life, which was my relationship with my mum. She would hate to think of me being so sad, you know. She would hate it. She would absolutely hate
it. But I also think that's like that thing about like, oh, people often say that, like, oh, they'd hate you to be sad, and you go, well, then she shouldn't have been such a good mum. Then maybe I wouldn't miss her. So like, it's all very well, isn't it? I think missing is just so much part of it. So, and again, it's about holding all these things at the same time. Like, yes, you can understand that humans die. That's, you know, that is literally what we're put here to do. It's the only thing that we will all share, shared experience. We are all born, we are all going to die. And then you can just miss someone.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just...
Exactly. It's,
I think I spent a long time looking for logic, and now I just kind of go, just miss it.
Yeah.
Sounds like you had a really, really nice relationship.
Yeah,
and sounds like she was a really great mum, and of course you, like, you just miss that. And I think, yeah, just holding that sadness and just letting it be is so hard because it's so painful. And because every little bit of you wants to, like, just be like, I just don't want to carry this today, you know? And especially that 6-week gauntlet you're talking about, I really feel for you, because I've had people message me as well saying, like, you know, their dad died on Father's Day, so they get this like double whammy. And it's like, because my anniversary is April, and then Father's Day I think is like June, isn't it? So I like have a bit of a break. May for me is like okay, and then Father's Day, and then we're kind of done until his birthday in December. So, you know, you kind of, but it's the thing you learn when you lose a parent, that, and I guess it's similar to having a child, you know, like suddenly when you have a child, there's all these weird dates that suddenly matter in a way that you didn't know. You thought all that matters is a birthday. And when you lose a parent, it's the same thing. You know, there's the anniversary of their death, the anniversary of their diagnosis, the date of their funeral, like all these things become significant. And not, you know, not everybody feels like that. But if you do, it's totally fine to allow that pain to be there.
Exactly. And that's just so, so beautifully put, and it's exactly right, you know. And I do think, for me anyway, grief has been, it's been a very expansive experience. It hasn't felt kind of restrictive or constraining. It's actually been incredibly expanding, and to the point where I feel I've seen, you know, it's like seeing colours of a rainbow that you just didn't know existed before. Mm. And I feel like through the kind of life-changing, really sort of reorganising experience of grief that I've been through, and losing my mum has given me kind of windows into feelings and comprehension of things which I just didn't even know existed before. And there's incredible kind of richness in that as well. And what I've tried to do now is, like, if something's happened and I just feel like it's fucking throwing me back down to the pits of it again, is just to not kind of shut myself up off from it and just kind of and resist it. It's actually just, as you say, to sit in it and to kind of look around what's there, because there's also some incredible things in that blackness too. And, you know, what I realized is that, you know, the very deepest, darkest pit of grief is love, isn't it? It's just your love, and it's how you love them. And if that's how you can kind of reframe it in your mind, is that, you know, these very sort of low, kind of flat, dark moments you can go through, if you actually reframe that as the kind of really being brought down to the kind of deepest kind of well of your connection of love to them, which really is, I do believe, the eternal nature, the eternal part of living, then that is a very reassuring thing. And it's I've learned not to be scared of my grief. I've learned to kind of find ways to be with it and let it come in when it really roars.
Well, Jess, thank you so much for talking to me. Aww. I mean, I knew about her anyway, but it's so nice to hear it. I think you really honour her, because she sounds like such a great mum. She sounds so nice and lovely. And so it's nice to know that, yeah, you know, the other side to what was already an amazing, dynamic, brilliant woman. And yeah, I'm just really glad that you that you told us about her.
Oh, well, honestly, I feel very, very honoured. So thank you.
You can follow Jess on Twitter at @IamJessMills and you can follow her on Instagram at @ThisIsJessMills. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. The artwork is by Jade Perkin. I've been Carrie Lloyd. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, you are not alone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.